It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined in the studio today with Dr. Robert Barnes, who's a pediatrician with the St. Joe Medical Group in New Haven. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Barnes.
My pleasure.
And the subject at hand for the first half of our show is vaccinations, and specifically we're talking about ped vaccinations and what young children need to be aware of and what the parents of the young children need to be aware of as far as getting your child vaccinated. And so I wanted to start off by asking, what age do you recommend folks start thinking about getting their kids vaccinated, and what are some of those basic vaccines that people are looking at to get their children ready for school and for life?
Well, the earliest vaccine can be given right in the hospital if a child's born in a hospital, and that's a hepatitis B vaccine. It is offered to the parents before the child leaves the hospital if the parents agree to that. It's not given automatically, of course. It requires a consent form. Generally, the rest of the vaccines for children, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends generally vaccines at 2, 4, and 6 months. And the schedule, of course, can be adjusted according to the parents' wishes. There's probably a total of about 15 diseases that we're trying to prevent with routine vaccinations. The 2, 4, and 6 month vaccines would include tetanus, whooping cough, diphtheria, hepatitis B, H influenza, which can cause things like meningitis or ear infections. There's a winter diarrhea virus called rotavirus, which can be prevented with an oral vaccine. That's pretty much it. After a year of age, vaccines can be given for measles, mumps, and rubella, and chickenpox. At the age of 9 years and up, the human papillomavirus, Gardasil, or Cervarix vaccines can be started in girls, and now they're being Gardasil, at least, is being recommended for boys as well. There's also some in Indiana. There's 2 shots required for sixth graders. If the parents are agreeable, a meningitis shot, usually it's called Menactra. There's another brand called Menimmune. And usually tetanus, whooping cough, and diphtheria are also boosted at that time.
Okay. And so vaccines, especially when it comes to young children, can kind of be a hot button topic. Some people feel very strongly that their children should not be vaccinated. Why are those opinions out there that vaccines aren't necessarily the best idea for young children?
I think the fear of vaccine reactions is really, really strong right now. And the vaccines generally have been so effective that a lot of illnesses that when I was a kid in the 50s that we had, we don't see anymore. We just don't see measles and mumps very often, chickenpox once in a while. So I think parents, the present generation of parents raising children, haven't seen a lot of these illnesses, the side effects of those, the consequences of those illnesses. So they tend to think that vaccine injury is a much greater risk to their child than the risk of the illness itself. Mm-hmm. And with the spread of information by the internet, maybe some of the information they're getting doesn't have a lot of scientific basis behind it. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a very emotional issue. One anecdote about a child who was damaged by a vaccine or may have been damaged by a vaccine tends to fill a parent with a lot of trepidation.
Mm-hmm. Are there any legitimate concerns that young parents should be worried about when they're taking their child to get their shots for the first time?
It's important that the office that gives the clinic or office that gives the vaccination gives the parents information about fever, soreness at the site of the injection, what the appropriate dose of Tylenol would be after that, mm-hmm. and what signs to call for to let the doctor know if there's a really unusual reaction. But the unusual ones are pretty rare. 3 hours of screaming, for example, sky-high fevers, a child's just personality changing completely, a little fussiness, a fever that responds to Tylenol. Those some parents may feel are major side effects. They're usually not the clinical ones that would prevent the child from receiving the next set of vaccinations. But it's important when the child comes around for the second set that the office asks about how the first one go. Even mm-hmm. if you didn't call the doctor, what did happen? Did you have any worries about how red and swollen the area was, high fever, how the baby acted. A seizure, for example, would be a major side effect which would prevent the next vaccine from being given. Luckily, those are very rare, but the minor side effects that we kind of expect, some parents are going to look on as being very dangerous ones, and they're very fearful for the next vaccine round to be given.
260-452-1185 is the number to call. Our phone lines are wide open if you have a question about pediatric vaccines. That's what we're talking about during the first half of today. And to do that, we have Dr. Robert Barnes, who's joining us from St. Joe Medical Group, and he's located in New Haven. So if you have a question, we'd love to hear from you. You can post on Facebook, or you can send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. So we've talked a little bit about some of the possible drawbacks of getting a vaccine, some of the hysteria that's developed over the years because of the internet and some high-profile people that insist that vaccines are not a good idea. And I'm sure that there are people that do have some negative reactions to vaccines, but it seems like overwhelmingly some of these vaccines, like the chicken pox and other ones that we get when we're young, are doing what they need to do to keep us protected from these viruses that are attacking us. So I know that there's an individual positive thing that happens when we get vaccinated and we don't have a poor response. But can we talk a little bit about the broader pictures about why it's important to get your child vaccinated?
Well, there are side effects of a lot of these illnesses. The most prevalent example in America, probably since 1982, the immunization rate for pertussis has been down. There were some major fears about the old DTP vaccine. It was called the whole cell pertussis vaccine. Pertussis is whooping cough. There were concerns about neurological damage in children. There were some studies actually that came out of Scotland that showed up on the Phil Donahue show, which was widely viewed by a lot of people. If parents didn't see it, maybe the grandparents saw it. And since, I think it was 1982, as I recall, since that time, we've seen significantly more whooping cough in this country. Just this year, there was a big epidemic. I believe Wisconsin was maybe the closest state. Mm-hmm. The vaccination levels have not been what we would like. It's particularly scary for infants. A lot of them end up in the hospital for a few days, maybe needing oxygen. They can turn blue with this terrible cough 24 hours a day. The vast majority of children survive it without any long-term side effects, but it certainly does carry a lot of morbidity. It's very, very stressful. And if your child's vaccinated against this, we're now vaccinating new moms and dads against it so that their newborn is not susceptible to it. We do think that helps your family, it helps your neighbors, it helps the kids at school. I think most cases of whooping cough that children are exposed to are from family members, mom number one, dad number two. It's usually not the neighbors. So if the parents are revaccinated against this this bacteria, we think that the infant population is a whole lot safer.
We're going to go to the phone lines real quick. We have Jen on line one. Jen, welcome to Health 360.
Hi, thank you very much.
What's your question?
I had a comment and then a question. Mm-hmm. I myself dealt with it, and then I help out a lot of young moms.
Uh-huh.
And their experience with, if they were to approach their certain doctors to maybe wait on the vaccine until their children were older, weren't well received. And a lot of doctors would give us flack, kind of make us feel bad, and just downright say, you're ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, you know, maybe we're not opposed to having the vaccines, but is there a problem with waiting until our children were a little older?
Okay, this comes up in my practice all the time. There are some practices, family practice and pediatrics, where if you don't do the recommended vaccination schedule with from the American Academy of Pediatrics, that they really don't want to discuss it any further. The big one for me is whooping cough. As we're coming into winter, I have parents who decide to wait or use an alternative schedule, and there are a lot of them out there. I try to emphasize for me the important one is the DPT vaccination. Pertussis is whooping cough. Parents may, you didn't mention this, but sometimes parents want to separate vaccines. They don't like the combination where six or seven or eight antigens are given all at once. Whooping cough, unfortunately, is not available that way. You have to give it in combination with tetanus and diphtheria. You don't really have a choice. Coming into winter, which historically has been the most prevalent time for whooping cough, I would like to see the infants in my practice get vaccinated at least twice. Some vaccines, hepatitis A, for example, when your child receives it, the immunity develops very quickly. Whooping cough, unfortunately, the first dose, you're still fairly susceptible to it. Second or third dose, you feel a lot better. So that's one. If parents want to wait, that's the one I'm always going to push for if we can get that started, and particularly this time of year, because historically winter is when babies get whooping cough. Mm-hmm. This year was a little different. This epidemic in Wisconsin was kind of late summer. The paranoia in the past few years, a lot of it has been about the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella. Jenny McCarthy is one of the proponents that this she thought caused her child's autism. The shot can be given as early as 12 months of age. My office, I've done it typically at 15 months. I've got parents who decide to wait until past age two, thinking that if a child isn't autistic by age two, the chances of this developing are minimal. Exactly. And I will go along with it, but I can't speak for other doctors.
And here's my point is the way you're conversing with me right now is very respectful. And maybe if more pediatricians were to take your approach, because really my point is how us moms, especially if the dads aren't there, I'm going to tell you, it's kind of like we're bullied. Right. And we're made to feel like you're being ridiculous. And that's what I would love to see. I think more parents are going to be on board if they're going to talk to us, doctors, pediatricians, the way you're speaking with me.
Well,
in a respectful manner, and let's work together to come up with it.
Right. I think,
and that's really my point is I wish more doctors were like you.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes time constraints are part of it. Obviously, it takes a lot longer to discuss this and just say, yeah, give my kid all his shots. You know, unfortunately, I can't speak for other doctors, and I probably tolerate the alternative vaccine schedule better than some doctors do. But it does take some time to get through all this stuff, and we can give you mountains of stuff to read. It may or may not get read. But I do have to feel that I take the point of view that if the parent has thought this through and it's an intelligent person who's looking for the best welfare for their child, I can't just discount it and say, you're crazy, Mom. I'm sorry. You're crazy. I don't find that's too productive. I have a feeling they won't be back for the next set of vaccines to talk about them. I mean, why would they, right? So I know the frustrations. I don't want to discount anybody's intelligence. I'd say probably I have more refusals for vaccines from the higher educated, better informed parents. A teenage mom probably typically isn't going to do the research that says, you know, I'm really worried about this one. Mm-hmm. And she's probably considering the patient time flow and the patient flow through the office, that's an easier patient mom to deal with than maybe the 33-year-old who's college educated and has done some research on this subject. Mm-hmm. I've got to give her credit for her brain power, and I try to do that and give her respect, yes. And you're right. It usually is mom we're talking to, not so often is dad involved in this discussion. You're absolutely right.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you.
All right. I want to make sure that we give folks some information about if they need to go and get their child vaccinated, but they don't have funds are low and they're expensive. They're not cheap, especially if you're uninsured. I know that there's Super Shot that does flu shots for people, and that's locally. And their phone number, I believe, is 260-424-SHOT. That's 7468. And then just about anywhere now at Walgreens and Kroger, I know you can get flu shots.
Right. Super Shot gives all the vaccines. Some of their there are locations where there may be in a church for maybe a half a day once a month. They may not have the ability to transport a medication that's kept in the freezer, a vaccination like chickenpox. So sometimes the patients have to go to a permanent site like the Board of Health, which I believe is now on New Haven Avenue. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Super Shot does all the vaccines, not just flu vaccines, right? And they do ask for $8 contribution for each vaccine given. I think that there's going to be some more restrictions on patients who have insurance for shots, they may discourage you from going to Super Shot, but I'd suggest you talk to them about when that is going to happen. We've heard rumors, and the timetable to me is not clear exactly when the people who have insurance may not be able to use Super Shot for their children's vaccines.
And if you have any questions, you can go to supershot.org. And again, their phone number is 260-424-7467. 68. We've talked a little bit about the benefits, the possible side effects, or what has been built up as possible side effects as vaccines. And also, I wanted to say a special thanks to Jen for calling in. And I think that a lot of times patients, and this is for any subjects, just want to feel like they're heard from their doctor. And especially if you're a new parent, whether you're a mother or a father, I think that's really important to feel like you're being heard and not just being pushed off to the side.
It does take some time. And depending on, you know, how the doctor's scheduled, I'd say I think time constraints are the biggest issue. I always want to give parents credit for the thought that's gone into their decision to give or not give vaccines. But it is a frustrating issue if a doctor's got 20 kids to see in a morning and, mm-hmm. you know, and 10 of them are supposed to be getting vaccines. It's sad, but I think a lot of it's just, you know, the time constraints. But I think the doctor who dismisses it may be partly because the anti-vaccine lobby doesn't tend to have a lot of scientific research to back up their fears. Generally, doctors are trying to think, okay, the side effects are, you know, 1%, a half of 1%. It's just those anecdotal cases that people find by word of mouth or on the internet are so frightening that to you as one parent facing this decision, it can seem like a mountain of a decision to make. A physician who sees thousands of kids every year and has very few calls back about side effects probably isn't taking it as seriously as you are. Mm-hmm. You're coming from different points of view, I think.
260-452-1185. If you have a question or a comment, we're talking about vaccinations in young children today. If you can always post on our Facebook page or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're joined in the studio this afternoon with Dr. Robert Barnes, who's with the St. Joe Medical Group, and we're talking about vaccines for young children. I know a lot of vaccine schedules are focused around the age of the child, but is there a good time of year to start that process, or does it all depend on age?
The only real temporal one is just the flu vaccine, which usually begins to be available around the end of August. And we typically expect the influenza. This is the respiratory type, high fever, cough, sore throat, and headache. I'm not talking about gastroenteritis where you have vomiting and diarrhea. We call that the flu, but that's not what the vaccine is for. Mm. Typically, we expect it to show up January and February in this part of the world, the Northern Hemisphere. The other vaccines generally are given by age. As I said, hepatitis B can even be given to a brand new newborn before he leaves the hospital. The other shots generally start at 2 months of age. They can be given as early as 6 weeks. If vaccines are started later, there are alternative schedules. They may be able to give in a little. They could be given a little bit closer together. If for some reason, for example, if a child's adopted from another country, sometimes we have to start vaccines over. We may not be sure that the medication, that the expiration date was followed, or that they were properly refrigerated. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about Asia, for example. Sometimes vaccine schedules get started again because we're not sure that the child was adequately vaccinated the first time. But typically the only one time of year thing is the flu vaccine is given in the fall. It's only available at that time. And I say I have a personal bias. I like to see that whooping cough's given before winter hits for the newborns if I can. Mm-hmm. If patients are going to wait, that's the one I try to get in before winter hits.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning a little bit before the show that Indiana overall seems to be doing fairly okay with the amount that we're vaccinating our younger population, but that
whooping cough nationally has been a problem. Indiana was not one of those states affected with a lot of whooping cough cases, but that's probably the strongest evidence. We've just seen more cases in the last 30 years than we ever expected, and it's because of fear of that vaccine. I mentioned in 1982 there was a thing called the whole cell vaccine. It was converted to one that's called acellular, which is what is given now. But recent research is showing that maybe that vaccine isn't as powerful. The effects don't last as long as the old vaccine. And that's one reason we think why we're revaccinating at sixth grade and we're asking new moms and dads in the hospital to also get it. The old vaccine, I think, maybe had a longer duration of action, but may have had more side effects.
Mm-hmm. And for other injections that we're talking about, other immunizations we're talking about, you mentioned before the show started that tetanus is one of the must-haves, really, when we're talking about young children starting to run outside and barefoot and not really thinking about what they're going to land on.
Right. It's tetanus vaccine is necessary in a child who could possibly have a puncture wound, a dirty puncture wound. if the neighborhood's immunized against tetanus, it doesn't help your child. What's called herd immunity. If everyone else is immunized against measles and mumps and chickenpox, your child's exposure risk is very small. But if you have that accidental puncture wound, if your child's in the emergency room and has never been vaccinated against tetanus, the ER or the doctor's office, if that's the first place sees the child, should be pushing very hard to get that child's tetanus vaccine started. There's also another injection available, HyperTet, which is hyperimmune globulin, which can be given to increase the child's immunity very quickly. That's active immunity and passive immunity. The passive immunity can be given. That's the one I think that's most important. If a child is injured that way, the doctors should be able to try to move heaven and earth to make sure that child gets vaccinated, does not leave that office or does not leave that emergency room or clinic without the tetanus vaccine being given. That's for me, the most important one of them all.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask before we start to wrap this first half of our show up, how does a parent check if their child's immunizations are up to date? We have a big push to digital records, health records, but how can they stay on top of that?
There is a state website. Indiana's done very well. It's called CHIRP, C-H-I-R-P. If your doctor's office participates in it, they are putting in the information, not only the date the vaccine was given, but even the lot numbers. If there was a group of patients who had trouble with the vaccines that came out of one certain vial from one certain manufacturer, that's in there. And I don't know the average a parent can go into CHIRP, but your school nurse can get into it. If you're in the emergency room, say at 3 a.m. on Sunday morning with, say, a dirty puncture wound, they can bring up the CHIRP. If your doctor's office has given that information to CHIRP, then that information is easily available. Maybe we can avoid shots that don't need to be given. Maybe the child had a tetanus last year and we forgot all about it. So that should be easily available. You don't have to wait until the doctor's office is open between 9 and 5 on Monday. I think that's a really good system, and it's working very well in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing before we let you go. There's some debate about injection site when it comes to giving these vaccines. Do you have is the thigh better? Is the arm better? Is there a preference with administrating them?
Generally, in the infants, we use upper outer thigh. It's the biggest muscle of the body. We can get it the deepest, maybe cause the least local reaction, least amount of redness and pain. At my office, I switched to the deltoid, the cap of the shoulder, at 1 year of age. But I know some places, I think SuperShot may be using the leg until the age of maybe age 5. Mm-hmm. We certainly, if parents have a preference, I hate to give kids sore legs when they're walking. So that's why I like to switch with toddlers. But if parents decide they really like the leg better, we usually don't have a problem with it. But I typically switch after a year to the shoulder, the deltoid muscle.
Mm-hmm. And how can folks get a hold of you and your office location?
I'm in New Haven, Indiana. I'm part of St. Joe Medical Group. My office phone's 493-6508.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Barnes, for being a part of Health 360 today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but when we're back, we'll have more Health 360 for you in just a few moments. Thanks for listening. The time is 12:30.
Sarah Elizabeth Richards hoped to have children one day, and as she got older, she made the controversial choice to freeze her eggs. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine said this week, freezing embryos should no longer be considered experimental. I'm Neil Conan, the changing science of fertility. Plus, we'll talk with an NFL replacement ref. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Wolfe. His new novel, Back to Blood, is set in Miami. Also, part two of my recent interview with Stephen Colbert. Since he loves music and loves to sing, for this part, we asked him to bring a few tracks of music that mean a lot to him and tell us why. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY. The time is 12:31. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you, 260-452-1185. You can always send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook. We're going to be switching gears the second half of the show. We're going to be talking about heart failure and treatment for that and what happens when the medicine has stopped working and we need to take a different approach. And to do that, we have Dr. Mark Jones here from the Lutheran Health Network. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So I want to, we had Dr. O'Shaughnessy on not too long ago on Health 360, and we focused a lot on heart failure. But just to give a springing board from that, let's just give a simple definition for folks that may have missed that show and what heart failure exactly means.
Well, heart failure is in great deal a clinical diagnosis. Clinical means that it's what you tell us that's going on with you, your history, and what we find on the physical examination, and then we support it with laboratory tests. But heart failure is primarily when somebody notices shortness of breath, especially shortness of breath with exertion or shortness of breath that awakens them at night. They may have noticed some edema or swelling of their ankles or feet start to form, having more fatigue, more tiredness, not able to do what they used to do, can't run the vacuum sweeper, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So can't walk. They used to walk a mile a day. Now I can't walk a mile a day. I get short of breath and get tired.
Mm-hmm.
And the findings that go along with that is when we listen to the lungs, we might hear some sounds. They're called rawls. It's like sticky sounds that you'd hear, or you might notice that there's swelling of the ankles and feet. We look at something called the jugular venous pulse. That's your jugular pulse up by the neck, by the angle of your jaw, and see how, if it's elevated or not. Those are all looking at signs of heart failure, and listening to the heart, we can hear different heart sounds or different murmurs. And heart failure, as you probably know, is kind of a wastebasket type of thing where all different causes of heart failure are kind of bundled into one.
Mm.
And then it takes cardiologists looking at it to try and separate out what might be treated medically best, what might be treated other ways, repairing heart valves that are bad, things like that. So I think Dr. O'Shaughnessy gave a great overview of what the medications are available to treat heart failure. And I think what I deal with at Lutheran, I'm involved in the transplant program, the ventricular assist device program, and also our heart failure program, which includes aquapheresis. And then we work in great lockstep with our palliative care doctors. And those are kind of the four options available when a person reaches the stage D of heart failure, when the medicines may not be working as well to control the symptoms, or when medicines have to start being reduced because the blood pressure is too low to give it, the kidneys start to fail, and you have to back off on some of the diuretics and some of the medications. At that point, we statistically, we know probably there's about a 3-year survival.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're at a 3-year survival, then some of the things that I do that I'm involved in evaluating patients, whether a candidate for a transplant or for a VAD or a ventricular assist device or other options, kind of are now available per guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
We follow the guidelines a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Cheney has kind of busted our guidelines because he's a little too old to get a heart transplant, but he got one anyway.
Uh-huh.
So for the most part, the patient's life expectancy usually has to be like mortality rate has to be 30% at 1 year or 50% at 1 year.
Okay.
And the things we look at to help us guide that are how many times have you been hospitalized. Mm-hmm. By the time you've had your fourth hospitalization for heart failure, then your life expectancy is about 6 months, mm-hmm. no matter when those hospitalizations have occurred. A lot of times we see them 2 or 3 in 1 year, so we know that you're failing, the medicines aren't working.
Right.
We need to look at something else. Mm-hmm. If we have to start taking the medicines away because the blood pressure is too low or the kidneys aren't working as well, also the same thing. Your life expectancy now is getting more finite than infinite, and you may have a 2 to 3 year life expectancy. We need to start thinking about other things. Mm-hmm. Anemia is one of those things also that gives it kidney failure. So all of these things make us think, well, now maybe we should be looking at something else. Okay. What else? What's the next step? The one thing we all like to look at is transplant because it gives us some of the best long-term results of any of the other options. Mm-hmm. Our statistics with transplants are that we expect about a 90% survival at 1 year. Mm-hmm. We expect a 50% survival at 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then we have deal with 15 and 20-year survivals, but it tends to, the life expectancy tends to go down. So,
right.
But that's better than the life expectancy of 2 to 3 years.
Right.
So now we have that option available to mm-hmm. us. Who might we evaluate? Well, we have some age cutoffs. It's usually someone, the age cutoff is 65 to 70. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is created equal, so there are some people that are 70 that look 60. There's some people that are 60 that look 75. So mm-hmm. we have to sort out how the diseases that have caused you to be in the position you are in mm-hmm. have affected the rest of the body, the kidneys, the liver, the lungs. That
right.
So we have to look very carefully at that. And that's part of our transplant evaluation. We have a multidisciplinary team. That means we have social workers, we have dietitians, we have our exercise physiologists looking at people very intently. Our coordinators all look at people to say, are you going to be the best option for this scarce resource, which mm-hmm. is the donor heart? Are we going to be good stewards of that donor heart in offering it to you? Mm-hmm. So that's a great deal of what we do. And are you sick enough?
Right.
I mean, that's the other thing we look at. Are you sick enough to use this heart?
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that are over 70, other than Dick Cheney, that we look more at ventricular assist devices. If they have a strong desire to mm-hmm. live, then we look at ventricular assist devices. Now those numbers, and the newest, again, the one that Dick Cheney had called the HeartMate 2,
uh-huh.
Is the one that's the most common to be put in. And
what is that exactly, the HeartMate?
There are a series of VADs. Uh-huh. VADs are, you put one end of it in the tip of the heart,
uh-huh.
suck the blood out,
okay.
and put it back in above the heart,
okay.
so that it goes to the rest of the body.
Gotcha.
Because your heart is not able to pump it.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So there have been a variety of these over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, there are two devices that are approved by the government
mm-hmm.
for destination therapy. In other words, that's going to be your final, that's going to be what we can do for you. One, and they're both made by the Thoratec company,
mm-hmm.
and one is the HeartMate 2, which is the most recent one, and it's a linear flow pump. The old pumps were pulsatile. They would have not really a bellows, but similar to a bellows that would pump the blood
okay.
with each beat, just like your heart does.
Uh-huh.
This is more like I liken it to the Hunt for Red October when you had that screw that would turn.
Uh-huh.
This is more like that.
Okay.
It's very quiet. If you listen to it, there's a hum, but it propels the blood at 10 liters per minute. We can get a great deal of flow out wow. of that. So that's the ventricular assist device. We also have criteria for that. Some people can be too sick. One of our big areas that we are concerned about is the nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Because nutrition involves how well you heal, how well you can get up and move around, how it's very integral to what we do. So that's why we have a dietitian on the team who looks at these people very carefully. But if we think that you would qualify that for that, then we think we have a better option than over a period of time. We'd like to see the one-year survival with this at about 80%. Mm-hmm. And that leaves us the two-year survival is generally about 66%. The three-year is going to be in the 30 to 40% range.
Mm-hmm.
The VADs haven't been around that long, so we're getting 4 and 5 year data now out of them.
Yeah.
The more we use them, the better the results get.
Okay.
I'm expecting to see, it's not going to come close to transplant probably, but I think we can get a 50% survival in a few years out at 5 years, which is better than your option that you had before you were evaluated for
that. Okay.
Now, for everybody that's evaluated for the transplant and for the VAD, ventricular assist device or VAD, we have a palliative care evaluation done.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is all palliative. I mean, this...
Right. Yeah. And describe, give us a definition for palliative.
Palliative does not equal hospice.
Uh-huh.
Palliative means that you are aware of your situation, that you understand that your life expectancy is going to be shortened from what you might expect. Everybody doesn't kind of give thought to, well, I've only got 2 years to live. And so by having our palliative care specialists come in conjunction with working with us, we make sure that people have a will. We make sure that people have a durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
We make sure, we say, what do you really want to happen to you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do this? Do you not want to do this? So, I mean, we don't want to force people to do something they're going to be uncomfortable with. So palliative care, at least initially, is that. And then down the line, palliative care can be, I think you're ready for hospice and moving into there. Because we have, statistically, we evaluate a lot of people, but we only maybe accept 20% for a transplant and 30% for our VADs. And so the people that are left need to be counseled and need to be understand what the situation is. So that's where palliative care comes in. The other option that we have available when we get into that stage D or the last stage of heart failure is aquapheresis, which is... We use this by definition when a person is resistant to their diuretics.
Okay.
So most people will take a diuretic or a water pill. When they have a little swelling, they'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you get into heart failure, you have to take a diuretic every day, sometimes twice a day, and sometimes in very large doses. Our equivalents, we use it as Lasix equivalent. Lasix or furosemide is probably the diuretic that everybody knows about. And most people, if they're on it for just a little swelling from something or other, are on 20 milligrams or 40 milligrams a day.
Mm-hmm.
We have people on, 40 milligrams twice a day, 80 milligrams twice a day, sometimes 120 milligrams twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
At that level, the kidney on occasion and starts to become resistant to the diuretic. It just doesn't get the fluid out of the system.
Right.
So the first thing we do is make sure they're taking the diuretic. Make sure that they aren't taking anything that interferes with the action of the diuretic. And one of the big things are non-steroidals, the ibuprofens, Aleve, those types of drugs interfere with the action of a diuretic. They don't let us be as effective. And if that's and making sure they're not taking excessive amounts of salt, excessive amounts of water. When we've gone through all that, or when they come in, we usually have to get the fluid out. And if they're resistant, then we use aquapheresis, which is a where we put a small catheter in the basilic vein which is the, up by the shoulder.
Okay. Kind of by the collarbone.
By the collarbone.
Okay.
But it, and we're a, and our current machines have filters that last 72 hours. Uh-huh. You have to have your blood thinned, usually with heparin, and then that keeps the filter from clotting off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're able to withdraw fluid. And this withdrawal fluid takes more sodium or salt out of the fluid out of your body mm-hmm. than the diuretic can.
Mm-hmm.
It also is more gentle on your kidneys. When we have large doses of diuretics, sooner or later, the kidneys start to fail a little bit. They don't go into total failure usually, mm-hmm. but they start to fail a little bit. So we can dial in the filtration rate we want, how fast we want the blood to be taken off, and, mm-hmm. and we generally start out with most people fairly slowly
mm-hmm.
until we learn how their body gives up fluid.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the plasma refill rate. So okay. it's the, you've got fluid in the tissues or mm-hmm. a swelling. How fast does that fluid move into the bloodstream so we can get it out mm-hmm. of the body? So and everybody's different. So we look at getting rid of the liquid from the body mm-hmm. in that manner. It's easier on the kidneys. And at Lutheran, we are now involved in a national study. It's called Avoid Heart Failure,
mm-hmm.
and it's a controlled trial. It's randomized by the company. They have people have to have be on a dose of Lasix of 80 milligrams a day. And if they come in with heart failure and they have at least 10 pounds of fluid in their system, they may qualify. And then we call the company and give them the data, and they'll mm-hmm. decide if they are accepted into the study. And if they are, then they get randomized. Half get randomized as the regular treatment, which is the diuretics or water uh-huh. pills, and usually intravenously. The other half get randomized to the aquaphoresis.
Uh-huh.
And the endpoint of this study is to see what percentage of the patients get rehospitalized in mm-hmm. 90 days.
Okay.
Because that's one of the big pitfalls of heart failure is that we have more frequent rehospitalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And the national average is 25%.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see if this treatment, which treatment gives the best, the lowest readmission rate.
Right. Okay. So is aquaphoresis, is it inpatient only or is it outpatient now as well?
We have some outpatients that okay. we do it on. All of our outpatients have had to have been inpatients first.
Okay.
And then we're hopeful that our educational pieces we have with the people that have been inpatients help prevent the need for it as outpatients. But we still have those patients who are very resistant to diuretics. And mm-hmm. if you try to give too much diuretics, their kidneys start to fail, that we will do outpatient aquaphoresis on over a period of time.
Okay.
And it may be every 2 weeks instead that they have to come in.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not like kidney dialysis where you remove fluid and it's every 3 times a week. We're hoping to be just every 2 weeks to get the fluid.
Mm-hmm. And just looking at the name of aquaphoresis, I know aqua is water, liquid, and then the phoresis, is that to take away? Is that where the name for the process comes
the
from?
The phoresis is when you take something out of the okay. body and filter it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the filtering that gives you the phoresis.
Okay. And generally the folks that have received the aquaphoresis process in Fort Wayne area, what does that typical patient look like? Like what age are they? Is there more males getting this treatment than females? Is there any data on who that patient looks like right now?
We have data, but my data person's not here with me today. The typical person we see,
uh-huh.
and it seems to be evenly split between males and females.
Uh-huh.
The males tend to be a little bit younger,
mm-hmm.
have more systolic heart failure, which is where the heart doesn't pump well.
Okay.
So those are the people where the ejection fraction is lower.
Okay.
Ejection
fraction means
that's the percentage of blood that's pumped out of the heart with each beat.
Okay.
And 30 years ago, nobody really had a clue that you could have heart failure with quote normal pumping action of the heart. Mm-hmm. So now we have it divided into heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, which means below 45% in general, or heart failure with a normal ejection fraction, which is above 45%. Most of the people that we look at that have reduced ejection fractions are men, and they tend to be 50s, 60s, 70s. Their heart function is not good.
Right.
The other half that we see, and this trend is what we see in the normal ejection fraction heart failure group, is more women who tend to be older, 75, 80, who have had more high blood pressure over the years, and their hearts get stiff. And that's what it's called diastolic dysfunction or heart failure with normal ejection fraction. The heart's a little stiffer.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend not to accumulate as much water, but they tend to accumulate it faster.
Mm.
And so this group of patients also tends to be a little bit more sensitive to how much you take off. So you have to, in our experience, we've had to take off fluid much more slowly, or else it will bother the blood pressure or the kidney function more than with the other group that's primarily a systolic dysfunction.
Okay. 260-452-1185 if you have a question in the next 8 minutes for our guest, Dr. Mark Jones, who is from the Lutheran Health Network, and we're talking about heart failure and what has happened, what are the treatment options when medication is not working and doing the job. We're talking a little bit about the process of aquapheresis right now. You can also post on our Facebook page, or you can send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. And again, we have about 7 minutes left in today's show. How long does the process of aquapheresis take? If I'm going in and getting that process done, how long can I expect to be in the hospital?
If you're going in the hospital as an inpatient, we can usually, as I say, the FDA filter life is 72 hours. So the FDA says you need to change the filter every 72 hours. And we usually are able to get enough fluid off in that 72-hour period, 3 days, 3 to 4 days, that you will feel comfortable sending a person out of the hospital. After they've had the aquapheresis, when we release them from the hospital, they usually are not on the same dose of diuretic that they have been on.
Mm-hmm.
We usually send them out with a much less dose, half usually, or none for a while. Mm-hmm. And then they have to be seen very quickly. We want them seen by their provider 1 to 2 days after they get out of the hospital, so we can see when we need to start adding back the diuretic.
Mm.
So there's while they're on the aquapheresis, they are not on diuretics.
Okay.
And so that's one of the important things of getting the kidneys to be a little bit more responsive to diuretics. Mm. It's called the diuretic holiday, where you don't give the diuretics for a while. And then when you start them again, you don't have to give as much, maybe half the dose, and you can get a better effect.
Okay. How long until you can expect to start feeling better?
Most people will tell you by the time they leave the hospital that they're feeling better.
Huh.
They all have breathing difficulties, so they're short of breath. And by taking fluid out, it's called dyspnea, which means shortness of breath.
Okay.
So their dyspnea profile improves significantly. It turns out whether you use diuretics or you use the aquapheresis, they generally get the same improvement over that period in the hospital.
Okay. And you all started using, this was introduced in 2010, is that correct? Or how long have you all been using this as a technique to deal with heart failure?
We have been using it, it's probably 2009.
Okay.
That we started using this fairly intently. And so we've had a good 3 years experience on doing this, and we're happy with it. It's not for every patient,
right,
of course. And on those selected patients that come in more frequently than usual, that for some reason the diuretics don't work on them, it's a good option for them.
Mm-hmm.
The group of patients that. That's the primary group. They're very difficult to manage with medications.
Mm-hmm.
Their time in the hospital, we make sure that they understand that they can, that they need to really restrict their fluid, watch how much salt or sodium they take in. We're usually at this level at 1,500 milligrams. Mm-hmm. That's for 24 hours. 2,000 milligrams is the typical diet, and that's 2,000 milligrams is a teaspoon of salt.
Okay.
So, and so we're down a little bit below that, 3/4 of a teaspoon, and that's looking at everything. What's in your food? At 2 to 3,000 milligrams of salt, it's basically don't use a salt shaker, and watch out for foods you know are salty. When you get down to the 1,500 milligrams, it's like, okay, you have to look at the can. You have to look at everything you eat to know how much sodium you think you got during that period of time or during your meal, during the day.
I was going to ask, what are some of the, it sounds like diet and sodium intake is definitely one, but what are there any other life-changing things that you're going to have to keep in mind after you undergo aquaphoresis?
Well, the diet and the water restriction are usually life-changing enough.
Yeah.
But we have to make sure that you take the diuretics. There are diuretics, and some people are fairly potent, and if they take them, they tell you, I can't leave the house for 4 hours. If I have an appointment at 9 o'clock in the morning, I can't take it and go to that appointment. And sometimes I forget when I get home to take it, and so they might be skipping doses because of that, or they have to go to the grocery store, they can't take their diuretic.
Right.
So there might be 3 or 4 times a week that they can't take the diuretic and forget to take it. So I think taking it, we're trying to work with somebody to say, when's the best time for you to take it? And we, and if you take, if you miss it in the morning, please make sure you get some other time and don't schedule appointments 2 days in a row if you can avoid it. You know, try to work with somebody to make sure that they can stay out of the hospital.
We have just about a minute left in today's program, and so I wanted to let you have the last word and just kind of summarize what you're most excited about with this whole process.
Well, this whole process is the hope that people who are starting to fail in their heart failure adventure, have some options. And I think everybody likes to look for options, and some of these things are available and would be very useful for some people to use. Now, others, we have the palliative care team that helps them understand why it may not be their best option.
And if folks are interested in finding out more about aquaphoresis and the work that you all are doing within the Lutheran Health Network, how would they best find that information?
The number for our the hospital is 435-7001. And just ask for the heart failure coordinator, who's Angie Logan.
Okay. All right, Dr. Mark Jones, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne. Thanks so much to our listeners and to both of our guests, Dr. Robert Barnes from the first half of our show and Dr. Mark Jones, who joined us during the second half of the show. This episode of Midday Matters will be podcasted by the end of the day, and you can go to nipr.fm to check it out there. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.